Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. Podcasting means you can go to that site, click, and listen to the show and archive shows anytime you want to. All this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. Well, I would like to welcome a great friend of ours to help us talk about the KSFR Fund Drive today. Eric Witt is here. He's the legislative liaison for Bill Richardson, and he's active in New Mexico's burgeoning film industry. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And we are here before we have our interview with Robert Perry. And Robert Perry is the author of the book Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, which can be yours if you call and make a contribution of $100 today to KSFR by calling 428-1393. 428-1393 is the number. Before we get to that, which we're going to do in just a couple of minutes, I want to make a call out to those of you who are listening who have never pledged to KSFR before. Maybe you've never given to public radio before. People who have been listening for all of this time without sort of pitching a dime into the hat every once in a while. Ladies and gentlemen, if that is you, why not take this moment right now to call 428-1393 in Santa Fe. The reason for that is that even if, you know, maybe your pennies are a little tight, you listen to this station, you want this station to be on the air. The only way we stay on the air is with your contributions. And think about what your life would be like without it, what your morning would be like without KSFR, your afternoon driving home from work. Think about that for a moment. And if this station means something to you, if listening to it means something to you, if it adds to your day, add a few pennies to our pot, to our coffers. We actually need them. It is the only way we stay on the air. 428-1393 is the number. Eric, I have to say, you are such an ardent listener to this station that I find that I can't get away with anything. Because if I say something that you take issue with, I hear about it in email.
Well, there you go. That's one of the great things about public radio is the variety of voices and the integrity of the voices that are aired on a station like this. It's really a unique resource in the community. That's why it's so important for all the listeners out there to support public radio. It's the only venue that I find in any medium that has, as I said, the variety of voices, the independence of thought and speech, and it's something that we support very heartily, both ideologically and also with our contributions.
Well, you support it ideologically, but you were just telling me before we went off on the air that there's all these people you sometimes disagree with.
Oh, there are a lot of people I disagree with that I hear on the stations and on KSFR and other public radio stations, but ideologically in the sense that this is the public venue where all these different voices can be heard. You know, there's no other place like this. There's no other medium like this, whether it's print medium, whether it's television medium, or any other kind of medium. This is a truly unique resource and something the community really needs to step up and support. So I appeal very strongly to everybody out there listening to please, whatever your political positions, your ideological positions, your entertainment preferences, your cultural preferences, all of those things you can find here in some measure on KSFR.
Now, do your colleagues over there in state government support public radio?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's in public service, you find the same variety of political opinions and advocacy that you do in the public at large. So it's a reflection of the greater community and the support for public radio for the same reasons is there in among public servants as among hopefully the community in general.
Well, we're going to hear the interview now with Robert Perry, which I recorded yesterday, and we won't be able to air the whole of it because it's about 49 minutes long, and but if you want to get the CD of the unabridged version of this interview, make a contribution of $35 to KSFR by calling 428-1393. That's 428-1393. And if you are calling from out of area, you can call the toll-free number, which is 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 907-5737. If you are a first-time caller to public radio, first-time contributor, do it now. Do it during my show. And you can get the book if you want it for a contribution of $100, the CD for a contribution of $35, or the combo pack of the two of them for a contribution of $125. 428-1393. Let's hear now from Robert Perry.
I'd like to introduce Robert Perry. He's an award-winning reporter, founder of the investigative website ConsortiumNews.com, and author of the book Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
This book could well be called The Disastrous Performance of the News Media Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush. You point out in many examples throughout the book that the mainstream media tend, here's one example, to harshly criticize Democrats and apply much more lenient standards to Republicans. What are some examples of this?
Well, I think perhaps the clearest example was the way that Al Gore was treated during the campaign in 2000. He was not only attacked by the right-wing media, which, of course, has become very powerful and expansive over the years, but he was vilified by the New York Times and the Washington Post in their news columns. There were repeated cases in which Gore's comments were taken out of context or simply just misquoted. He never did say he invented the internet. He was accused of claiming that he was the one who discovered the Love Canal case when that wasn't what he said. It's clear from any fair reading or fair listening to the tape of him talking to some students in Concord, New Hampshire, about how he was involved in some of that wastewater treatment cleanup, that he wasn't claiming to have discovered Love Canal, but that's the way it was presented to the American people. So you had numerous cases where someone like Gore had to go through the slings and arrows of the media trying to show it wasn't liberal. Whereas on the other side, George Bush and Dick Cheney were allowed to play very fast and loose with the truth. There was an interesting case during the vice presidential debate in 2000 when Dick Cheney insisted that his fortune at Halliburton had not been involved with the U.S. government, that the U.S. government had not helped him in making his money, and that simply wasn't true. He had not only received the benefit of Halliburton being a big defense contractor, but he had personally lobbied for loan guarantees that helped Halliburton's bottom line and thus Cheney's bankroll. That was pointed out at the time, but was never picked up on by the mainstream media, even as Dick Cheney was accusing Al Gore of puffing up his own resume. Cheney was the one who was actually puffing up his resume and was never called on it. So that's the sort of double standard that we came almost to get used to in that period, and it's continued through to the present.
Why the double standard?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to the 1970s, and I arrived in Washington in 1977 with the Associated Press, and during the 1980s did some of the what became known as the Iran-Contra scandal, and went on to Newsweek and then PBS Frontline. So I've seen a lot of this firsthand. But if you go back to the mid-1970s, after Watergate, after the end of the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers and other examples of the press actually doing its job and telling the public what was going on, the right wing and, generally speaking, the Republicans felt they were being unfairly treated. They thought that Richard Nixon had been driven out of the White House unfairly. They felt that the press had undermined the war effort in Vietnam. So they began an effort, and you can trace it back to the late 70s, of concentrating large sums of money somewhat through foundations, conservative foundations, also through wealthy right-wing individuals, into media. They built up their own media infrastructure. They also supported groups that went after reporters in the mainstream press who wouldn't toe the line. So if you were digging up stories that, for instance, made the Reagan administration look bad, you would be targeted with smear campaigns and other ways of pressuring you. So and that really led to reporters losing their jobs or having their careers badly damaged.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah, to some extent, sure. I mean, it happened to a lot of people. But when I was doing the stories about the Contras and the Nicaraguan Contras and some of their abuses, I came under increasingly heavy attack. My patriotism was questioned. Stories would be gone through with a fine-tooth comb, looking for something that could be made an issue out of. That sort of thing was fairly common. There were also smear campaigns done against some journalists. For instance, some of the women journalists in Central America, and that was really the first American conflict where women played a major role in actually reporting a war. And some of these groups up in Washington, including people working for the State Department, would put out stories about women sleeping with Sandinistas and being biased, and they damage people's careers that way. And the overall result, though, as we go through that period and come into the 90s, was that, first of all, a lot of good people were pushed aside as journalists. The ones that remained learned a lesson not to go into these kinds of stories. There was a very strong feeling by the time you get to the early 90s that it was important to be tougher on a Democrat when Bill Clinton came in than any Republican. And the main goal of the press, the mainstream press, was to prove it wasn't liberal. And so you saw this, by the time Clinton became president, there was a merger almost of interests, with the mainstream press wanting to show that it wasn't liberal and attacking Clinton excessively on some of these minor scandals, and the right-wing press, which by then had grown to be a very powerful force, newspapers, magazines, increasingly talk radio. By the mid-1990s, Fox News had come online. So you had this enormously powerful right-wing press. You had an intimidated or collaborationist mainstream press at that point, willing to go along with the right, and you didn't have... You had people who were trying to stand up to it being isolated and attacked by these right-wing pressure groups inside the media. The cumulative effect of that was devastating. And by the time you get to 2000, a lot of that was taken out on Al Gore, and it was also it really set up the stage for George Bush becoming president. And then once 9/11 happened, this almost unified effort to make him seem like a stronger, more effective president than he was, leading into the Iraq War.
Why do you think there was not the parallel liberal or democratic pressure on the media to tell its story?
Well, that's a good question. I think in part it goes back to that same time in the mid-1970s when I think maybe liberals or people on the progressive side felt that the mainstream press would do the work for them. They didn't have to really invest in that. They could invest in other things. They could, for instance, help feed the poor. They could help buy up endangered.
And we're here at the Santa Fe Baking Company. The number is 428-1393. That's the number for the KSFR fund drive. Now, we faded this question down right now because we want to get back to our great friend Eric Witt from Governor Richardson's office to talk about public radio and why it is that people who are listening right now should contribute by picking up their phones. What is it that you actually listen to, that you listen for on public radio, Eric?
Well, I listen, again, for a variety of perspectives on things. I listen for things that you don't get through the mass media. We were discussing this morning, for example, on Amy Goodman's show, they were talking about the situation in Iran. The visit by President Ahmadinejad to Columbia University and then subsequently today to the UN and had two Iranian experts, discussing what the real situation is, and what does the president represent, President Ahmadinejad, in terms of the political power structure, the reality in Iran, which is not much, it turns out. He's polling at about 25% popularity in Iran versus 28% for Bush here in the United States. So that gives you an idea of his popular support, but also...
They could form a club.
They could form a club, and they'd still be, just barely over 50% combined. But the fact that he doesn't really control anything, that it's still people like Khamenei, the former president, Rafsanjani, that are there, that are vastly much more influence foreign policy of Iran, what their political position is, which is much more moderate and willing to work with the West and the United States in particular, but we don't hear that from our political leaders here. We don't hear that through our mainstream media here. What we hear is Iran pursuing nuclear weapons and threatening the state of Israel, threatening the United States, threatening the stability in the world, in the Middle East, and then subsequently in the world. But we don't really hear what the reality is on the ground in Iran itself.
And you do hear those perspectives on KSFR, on the BBC, on Democracy Now!, which we air twice a day, even to some extent on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. If you like this station, if you like this program, if you like public radio, if you love public radio, if you've contributed before, if you've never contributed before, pick up, please, your telephone. I always say please because that's how I was taught by my mother. 428-1393. 428-1393. 1393. If you are calling from out of area, you can call Toll free, 1-866-907-5737. That's 907-KSFR. I hear the intake of breath from Richard
Block.
Yes,
indeed. That's my signal, isn't it? We do have some people who love KSFR and who love Radio Cafe. We got a call from John Ressler.
Thank you, John. He was just here in the baking company.
Yes, he said he's contributing to all of his favorite shows, and Mary Charlotte is number one.
Oh, thank you, John. You rock.
And we also want to thank Cindy Eaton.
Thank you, Cindy.
And Leah Siegel, who called.
Thank you so much to all of you.
We do thank all three of you. And the phones are, we're getting some activity there. So I'm going to go back and check that out. And every time we can thank some folks, we'll thank some folks.
And if you don't want your name read on the air, never fear. You don't have to have your name read on the air. Just tell the people when ask that you would like to be cited as anonymous. Or Bugs Bunny or whatever name you choose.
We don't use your name without your permission.
Or Eric Cartman.
And I just want to also just take a second before I get away from here and welcome you, Eric. Nice to have you with us on the station. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Richard. Great to be here. You know, we're sitting here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, and it strikes me as I look around that this is a metaphor for public radio and KSFR, looking at the gathering place of the community here and stuff. And as you like to say, you know, the contribution of one cup of coffee a week is something that makes a significant difference. You know, folks, not that we're obviously trying to take business away from the great Santa Fe Baking Company.
No, but if you think about the $2 a week that you might spend on coffee, if you add another $2 a week and give that to KSFR, or spend $1 a week on coffee and the other dollar give to KSFR, it actually, if everybody does that, makes a huge contribution.
There you go.
We're going to hear a couple of announcements from our beloved underwriters, and we're going to go back to Robert Perry talking about his book, Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. It's actually written by Robert Perry and his two sons, Sam Perry and Nat Perry. The book can be yours for a contribution of $100. The CD of the show, which is much longer than we're going to hear today, he actually gets into some very interesting stuff, some of which we'll hear, can be yours for a contribution of $35. Call now 428-1393 or 1-866-907-KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books and their owners Eva and Edward Borens, celebrating more than 30 years as booksellers. Located at 376 Garcia Street, where adventurer Peter Heller will celebrate the publication of his newest book, The Whale Warriors, The Battle at the Bottom of the World to Save the Planet's Largest Mammals, on Monday, October 1st at 5 p.m. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com. KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care Community Cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
Another story you tell is of the darker side of Colin Powell, the first Secretary of State under George W. Bush. And your writing about him goes all the way back to the Iran-Contra affair.
Well, it goes back even further to Vietnam.
That's right.
But the simple reality about Colin Powell is that he was never the hero that he was made out to be. He was really an opportunist. And if you understood his history, going back to his days in Vietnam and even both as a young officer, as an advisor in 63, and then later in 68 as an executive officer for the AmeriCal division, where he helped steer an early investigation away from the My Lai massacre, what you see is a guy who always put his career first. And then, of course, I follow this through an area that I know more about, which is, of course, the Iran-Contra affair. And what I did with that was I took the depositions that had been done but largely ignored, almost entirely ignored, of Pentagon officials who described how those missiles got to Iran. And what comes out of those depositions is a remarkable story about how Colin Powell played this central role in the Iran-Contra scandal that was largely missed, almost entirely missed at the time. He was, without him, without his very clever way of pulling strings and manipulating matters inside the Pentagon, those missiles probably never would have gotten to Iran, and the Iran-Contra scandal might never have happened, at least as we knew it. There were people in the Pentagon who said if they knew what Powell was up to, if they knew where the missiles were going, they would have stopped it. But Powell was a very clever bureaucrat and was able to essentially jerry-rig the system so the missiles could get to Iran without other people in key spots in the Pentagon knowing. So you have Powell playing various roles that most Americans don't know about, but which explain why he was so favored by both the Reagan-Bush crowd in those period of the 1980s and early 90s, and then later by the Bush-Cheney crowd. He had proved to be a very useful operative for them. And when you juxtapose that against his behavior during the Iraq war buildup, things suddenly make sense. It's not this anomaly where Powell, for some reason, goes off and gives this false testimony to the United Nations. It really is part and parcel of his whole career. I think if one understands that, one has a much fuller sense of the history of this period.
Let's talk about Vice President Dick Cheney. He's another character with a long history that tends not to be remembered or written about in the press. His history in presidential politics also goes back to the 80s and before.
Right, and I've known Dick Cheney on a somewhat of a personal level since the early 1980s. I was the Associated Press pool reporter that went with a congressional delegation down to Grenada after the U.S. invasion of Grenada in 83, and Cheney was one of the Republican leaders on that, and I spent some time with him then. And I dealt with him during the Iran-Contra period. He was a very important figure in the Congress. Of course, his history had been as a senior official in the White House during the Ford administration. So he had seen some of the efforts to rein in the imperial presidency of Richard Nixon, and he didn't like it. And he represented, even when he was in Congress, the view that the executive should have pretty much total free rein, especially relating to foreign policy matters. And during Iran-Contra, he put together what was known as the Minority Report, which was signed off on by most of the Republicans on the Iran-Contra investigation. And it was written in part by David Addington, who's now Cheney's chief of staff. And it's a very important document for understanding where they went under the Bush II presidency, because it showed that Cheney and Addington and others envisioned the presidency not being something that could be challenged or controlled by Congress when it came to matters of national security or foreign policy. What's happened with as that sort of was put into play in the early 2000 period, what we've seen is, of course, an expansion of presidential power beyond even what we were seeing in the 1980s. But it is true that the Iran-Contra affair can best be understood as a kind of precursor to what we have now. It was the beginning of this return of the imperial presidency, the reassertion of the kind of executive powers that we had seen under Nixon. There had been this period when that had been pushed back, but that pushback was blunted by the 1980s. And by the time you get to Bush II, and especially after the 9/11 crisis, then you start seeing the presidency coming back in full bore. So what we're seeing really was an interesting transition through our recent history, which I think also has been missed by most people in the news media, where you really had something happening in the 70s to try to stop this problem, Iran-Contra being the important point where that was reversed, and then that accelerating when you get into the George W. Bush presidency.
So after 9/11, 2001, we saw the emergence, as you're talking about, of the Bush Doctrine. What did this mean in terms of foreign policy and then in terms of domestic policy? Let's start with foreign policy.
Well, the Bush Doctrine held that whatever the President of the United States thought was necessary to protect the country could and would be done, that there were no limits, in effect, that if it required invading a country, whether or not the United Nations approved or whether there was a truly strong case, you could still do it. and that Bush was asserting his right to do it. There was an important speech he gave at West Point, which laid out, in effect, this idea, this unilateral power that he could exert around the world in defense of U.S. national security interests as he saw them. So you had that. That also had other components, however, including this idea of using information or misusing information, if you will, to make those cases seem more plausible and reasonable than they actually were. And there was the domestic side of this, that if you accept this idea, which was laid out by the Bush administration after 9/11, that there was a war on terror that had no boundaries, that it existed literally every place in the world, including the United States, and that it had no end, that it was indefinite. And this was a very important change in the other cases where presidents have exerted extraordinary executive power. For instance, when Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, suspended habeas corpus in some areas, even though that, in a sense, was envisioned by the Constitution, which talks about a time of rebellion or insurrection. That was a case where the geographical area was limited and the time was limited. The war was going to end. In the case of Franklin Delano Roosevelt imprisoning or detaining Japanese Americans, while that may have been a fairly outrageous abuse of power, it was at least a defined in terms of time that when the war was over, this was going to end. So the idea of an emergency action, which many Americans could understand, whether it's justified or not, they could certainly see, well, in the case of a crisis, sometimes you have to do things that the Constitution may not particularly smile upon, but you may have to do it. But those were all limited. In the case of what Bush was laying out, the reason it was so extraordinary and is so extraordinary is that he's saying that this war is everywhere. In other words, it is within the United States as well as outside, and that it has no time limit. And if you put that and juxtapose it with his theories about the so-called plenary powers of a president in wartime, and plenary in this case means full or total, that it effectively means that the whole idea of inalienable rights for citizens has been wiped out. Because if the president has all the power, can do whatever he wants, he can waive habeas corpus, he can order torture, he can order executions, he can basically do whatever he feels is necessary. There are no rights for the person who is being targeted in this way. Then we have a whole different system. And it's not just an emergency moment where you might do this for a week or two or a couple years even. It is supposed to go on indefinitely. They talk about the long war. They talk about a war that will last a generation or more. In effect, it's an endless war because terrorism will never be fully stopped.
Well, not only
they acknowledge that.
As you've talked about in your book, when you have a war on a tactic.
Okay, we are back in the Santa Fe Bacon Company with Eric Witt. We are listening to the interview with Robert Perry, Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Robert Perry is an investigative journalist who's actually been working in Washington for over three decades. And this book is sort of compendium of all the information that he and his sons have compiled on their website, their investigative website, consortiumnews.com. The book can be yours for a contribution of $100 to Santa Fe Public Radio, KSFR, if you call 428-1393. 428-1393 is the number. Please give us a call now. We are especially inviting new listeners or new contributors, maybe old listeners, who've never given to public radio before. If you can simply give within your means, even if that's a $25, even if it's a $10 contribution, or maybe within your means you've never given before is a $150 contribution. 428-1393 is the number. And Eric Witt, when we were listening to the interview, we were also talking about New Mexico's burgeoning film industry.
Yeah, we were talking about your characterization of it as burgeoning, which it seems everybody and their dog, including your two dogs, Milk and Honey, have picked up as the descriptive term for the industry. We just had, or for the industry here in New Mexico, we just had a Hollywood Reporter special edition last Wednesday that characterized New Mexico's burgeoning film industry.
Well,
New Mexican did a feature on Sunday, New Mexico's burgeoning film industry.
The back background of this is when we started talking about New Mexico's film industry, I decided I was going to use the adjective burgeoning every single time we talked about it, and apparently it's caught on.
Yeah, it's caught on to the point where it's like calcifying the rest of the language, you know, for the rest of the people reporting.
428-1393, by the way.
It's funny because just on Bob Edwards, he had a linguist on who was saying that underprivileged kids, you know, by the time they get to kindergarten, have up to 32 million fewer experiences and exposures to words, you know, than more privileged kids, and how it's a big detriment and a setback when you try to, you know, start teaching these kids about stuff, and how language really reflects the evolution of the human brain, both individually and over time as a species. So, you know, please, people, send in synonyms for the word burgeoning so we don't devolve. You know, it's like the...
Blossoming?
Yeah, blossoming.
Fledgling?
It's burgeoned.
Flowering?
It's already burgeoned.
Germinating?
Germinating.
Nascent?
Yeah.
Pollulating?
Yeah, it's like we're going, you know, it's that evolutionary chart, you know, the evolution of humankind that starts with a rock and goes to the tadpole and then the hamster and ends up with the hairless monkey. You know, it's like we're going back to the rock.
We've evolved straight from Lemmy Winks the hamster. 428-1393 is the number to make a contribution to KSFR. I think one of the things that's important to talk about when we talk about the media, when we talk about New Mexico's burgeoning film industry, or when we talk about the various cultural activities that are happening in town, is that public radio is the medium that brings them all together. This is where you hear about all the other things that are going on in town, and this is where people come to. I get countless emails a day. I looked on my email reading program, and I average 26,000 emails a year, which may be fewer than you get, Eric Witt, but still, it's an awful lot to sort through, and a lot of it is from people in Santa Fe who would like us to announce other things that are going on, whether it be cultural or other media events in town. And that's how the whole thing works. That's how it all comes together and burgeons forth.
And burgeons forth. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and we have a few burgeoning here, people. A few burgeons. A few burgeons here to thank.
Like a burgeon. Go ahead,
Some
Richard.
Wonderful, wonderful people to thank. Nancy Sitter. Thank you very much, Nancy.
Nancy Sitter, thank you.
And Judy, who just wants the name Judy used. So
thank you, Judy.
Judy, Judy, Judy. And Philip Douglas. Thank you very much, Philip. And right on the phone right this very minute is Pamela Sweeney.
Thank you very much, Pamela.
So keep those phones ringing. It's the magic. That's the music we love to hear and we need to hear. And I tell you, one of the nicest things to do during fund drives is say thanks to folks.
Well, I have to say, when we were listening to the interview, Eric Witt said an extraordinary thing. You said, you know, I actually like the fund drive time of year.
Yeah, I do like. I'd like the fun drive time of year on KSFR. I don't like it on necessarily other meetings. But, you know, you folks, as I mentioned, it's equivalent to the sweeps week that they use on television to set their ad rates, their viewership levels, and then subsequently their ad rates.
It's like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue?
Exactly. They do all the TNA stuff and the bikini stuff, you know. But you folks put intellectually stimulating programs on during the fun drive. You have great guests. I'm honored to be one of them. Thank you very much. You know, the guest pitchers on here. And I really enjoy the fun drive. Plus, you really see the involvement of the community. It makes you feel good. It if you contribute. I mean, this is something that Richard talks about all the time. It's something you talk about, Mary Charlotte, everybody. That when you contribute, you really feel part of the team.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, and you could probably do a psychological evaluation of why this is. But when you are listening to the public radio. Please give now spiels that we are doing and that we have to do twice a year in order to stay on the air. If you don't give, these conversations are really annoying. And if you do give, suddenly they sound really quite good.
They do. They do.
That's a very good point. It's a wonderful thing because once you've made your I don't call it a contribution. I think it's an investment that we make.
Somebody just came up to me and handed me a wad of bills. And
my goodness.
I want to thank Michael for handing us a contribution in cash right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company. What a guy. And we are going to give you the number one more time, 428-1393, 428-1393, or toll-free, 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 907-5737. Please call now, especially if you've never given to KSFR before. Please give a call now. Make a contribution within your means. we are going to hear right now a commentary from Ron Bloomberg.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. Here's my dilemma. It's pledge week at the station. Now, I can understand why you would call it a pledge. Look at all the goodies you get. Radio Cafe, Journey Home, Bob Edwards, Jazz Blues, one of the great news teams anywhere, Camp Love Wave, The Food Show. So you should be contributing. But what if you were me? I have to write a commentary every week. Get in my car, drive down to the station, record it. Know how much I get paid? Zippo. In fact, it costs me money. Do they ever offer me a piece of carrot cake, a chili burger? No, never had a dinner. So don't you think that's a big enough contribution for me? After all, I'm a writer. That's what I do for a living. I have responsibilities, expenses, a sink that keeps backing up. I should be having my own pledge drive. But you know, I'm going to take the high road here. Know why? Because we're an independent station. We're the underdog. We say what needs to be said. We're the little guy fighting the big conglomerates. I'm not saying I'm the little guy. I'm 6 feet tall. But KSFR needs our support. Even those of us who never even get a piece of carrot cake. I'm going to make my pledge, and so should you. Because Santa Fe needs us. The country needs us. The world needs us. And damn it, the Dixie Chicks need us. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.
Another free ride that the press seemed to give George W. Bush was an acceptance of his lack of foreign policy experience, giving him credit for quote unquote instinct and decisiveness. To what extent were Bush's instincts at work in his foreign policy versus the plans and thinking of a group of neoconservative politicians that were behind him?
Well, certainly the neoconservatives have essentially laid out the map that's been followed, and some of that also goes back to this earlier period. When I was covering the Central America wars in the 1980s, I encountered many of the neoconservatives, people like Elliot Abrams, and who was Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, Robert Kagan, who was head of what was known as the Public Diplomacy Office at State. So I knew a number of these fellows personally, and they were very smart and very good with words. They also had this attitude that they should manipulate the American people. And they had a concept which we started hearing about, and at first the words were even classified. Later they were as treated less sensitively. But the words were perception management. They felt it was very important to manage the perceptions of the American people. And the key to that was to control the information flows. So they went after the press, tried to throttle what we could do. They also went after the intelligence community back in the 80s, trying to intimidate the CIA analysts who were seeing things differently. They were seeing a decline in the Soviet Union. They were seeing that they were not alarmist about the threat from, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. They weren't towing the line either. So there was an effort to purge the CIA and to intimidate the mainstream press, which went along very effectively. So the neocons developed that theory. They also wanted to exert this unilateral power of the United States, especially after the end of the Cold War. And they had a particular interest in the Middle East, where they saw Israel as the standard bearer of Western values, and they saw the Muslim countries as rather backward and primitive. So there was this effort to impose various kinds of U.S. domination in this area, and they put together strategies and arguments and made their case and twisted the information when needed. And that went on through the 90s and into the current presidency, where they were brought back into key jobs when George W. Bush returned. So you had that element. You had the neocons, the neocons that are presenting a kind of intellectual framework. And then you had Bush, who was, in many ways, after 9/11, there was an effort by the mainstream press and the conservative press to kind of buck him up. The feeling was that he had to be given a lot more confidence that we could handle this very difficult situation. There was almost no criticism of Bush that followed 9/11. It was a very strange period where, despite some of the facts which would have indicated a shaky leader, he was treated almost like he was chosen by God. In fact, there's in the book Neck Deep, I cite this this interview that Tim Russert did with Laura Bush and Rudy Giuliani, and there was a Catholic cardinal involved. This was in late 2001, where the Russert asked this question, suggesting that George Bush was picked by God to represent the United States at this very difficult time. And the only person on the panel who disagreed was Laura Bush, who said that's not how God works. But Giuliani went on and talked about, oh, I have to disagree with the First Lady here. And so there was this sort of there was this deification of Bush, and that fed into his ego. He began to see himself that way almost. So I think what might have been considered somewhat a well-meaning effort by the media to shed its objectivity and its professional duties, and instead sort of be patriotic and to bolster the president at this difficult time, actually went against the interests of the American people in fundamental ways. It created an image of Bush that he then took on as his own, which was that he was infallible, that his gut, his instincts were perfect, and that and in fact some people would say that he had the right stuff, the right man, as one of the titles one of the books of the time said, because he wasn't burdened down with all this knowledge and information and nuance. He could see things with moral clarity was the phrase, and he could take these actions decisively without having to worry about all the things that folks who knew too much would worry about. So his ignorance was almost made into a positive. The results, I think, are now much more evident. But that was a big chunk of what the mainstream media was doing in the months and years after 9/11.
So now you fast forward to the present in Iraq, where we have essentially anarchy, a full-on Iraqi resistance to the occupation by the United States. You have thousands of Americans who are dead, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are dead, of no apparent political or economic gains except to those who profit from war. You've got a whole world against us. When you look at the big picture, do you see incompetence or do you see intent? And if there's intent in this, what is the intent?
Well, there's some intent in that the view of the neoconservatives was to take out Iraq as a powerful Arab state. The concern was that that Saddam Hussein was an Arab leader who had a powerful military and who could cause some trouble in that region, and to replace him with essentially an American colony was considered a smart strategy in a geopolitical way. The thinking also was that once Iraq was taken, that the U.S. would move on and force regime change in Syria and Iran. The neocon joke in 2002 was after taking Baghdad, should they go east or west? And the joke was, real men go to Tehran. And so that was their attitude. And the thinking was that once they took Iran and Syria, that they could then roll up Hezbollah and Hamas as enemies of Israel and effectively gain control of that whole region and essentially put in Arab governments that would be amenable to whatever the United States wanted. It, of course, proved to be a delusion that it was not going to be nearly that easy, but they certainly thought it would. They talked about the cakewalks into Iraq and so forth. But so there was a strategy. There was an intent, and by devastating Iraq, they have achieved a little bit of that. Iraq is certainly not, in a conventional military sense anyway, a threat to anybody at this point. There might be a threat from terrorism or the rise of Islamic militancy coming as a reaction to Iraq, but that's a bit different. So that was the rational. If there was a rational element, that's what it was. It was to try to restructure the Middle East in that way. It wasn't much to put in democracy. That's the phrase they keep using. It was really to put in compliant governments. That was the key. They didn't want democracy to lead to more radical governments, which has happened in a couple of places where there's been where there have been free elections in the Middle East. The idea was to achieve a kind of controlled democracy, if you will. Since it didn't pan out that way, what has been what's been created is a really insoluble situation where the troubles in Iraq have increased the likelihood of regional instability and possible dangers not only to U.S. interests but also to Israel. So there's been this boomerang effect that was not really anticipated, but has certainly come to pass.
In light of that, what do you think the saber rattling in Iran is really all about?
Well, I think there's a strong element within the Bush White House and the administration that believes that there has to be an attack on Iran before much longer. President Bush has vowed that he will not leave office with Iran on the march or on the move toward getting a nuclear weapon. There have been more recent stories, but you know I was writing about this at our website, consortiumnews.com, going back to early this year, when it was becoming increasingly apparent to some of my sources that there was a serious move toward U.S. airstrike against Iran.
And we are here in the Santa Fe Bacon Company listening to the interview with Robert Perry about his book, Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. And sorry we had to cut off some of these segments here. There's much, much more. You can get a copy of this interview on CD delivered to your own house in a plain brown wrapper for $35. Call 428-1393, 428-1393. Do we have any thank yous to our dear burgeoning listeners?
Mayor Charlotte, let me see if I can find Richard. Hold
All
on
right.
a moment.
And we've just got a couple of minutes left in the program, and we want to let you know once again that if you have never contributed to public radio before, and if you like the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, this is the time to do it. 428-1393 or 1-866-907-5737. That's 907-KSFR. Eric Witt, any last words before we go?
Just get on the phone, folks. You know, put your contribution in, join the team. You will be much better for it as a human
being. I heard
being.
My name taken in vain here.
Richard Block, do we have any thank yous?
Yes, we do.
Let's hear them.
Light Lars Sarong.
Thank you.
With great appreciation for all the KSFR does. Trish Lopez.
Thank you.
And Anna, I think it's Lobet.
And
I may be mispronouncing that. If I am, I apologize,
it
Anna.
It could be Lobe.
It could be.
428-1393. Thank you so much to our wonderful listeners. And if you haven't called yet, I want to say, and I said this yesterday, but I'm going to say it again. There are people who come up to me and say, I listen to the Radio Cafe all the time. And it makes me very happy. If you listen to the Radio Cafe all the time and you haven't called yet, please call now. You will be happy you did, and I will be happy you did. And you don't have to have your name read aloud. 428-1393 is the number. And for all you fans of not only the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, but Democracy Now!, Jazz, and the many other programs we have on the show, this is the time to call. And I'd like to give Eric the opportunity to give a call to all state and public employees.
Get on the phones, folks. You just heard the call. I will say that Trish Lopez, whose name you just read, works with us down at the governor's office. She's a new member of the team down there. Thank you very much,
Thank
Trish,
you.
For your contribution. And, again, this being the voice of the public, I would urge all the public servants and public employees to contribute to the well-being of your voice, KSFR.
And thank you, Eric, for your tremendous support of this station. It's really appreciated.
It's my honor, Richard. Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Witt is legislative liaison for Bill Richardson, and he is active in New Mexico's burgeoning film industry. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Thank you, Eric Witt, for being here. Thank you, Richard Block, for all you do. Thanks to Dal Dearman, the many volunteers who are in the phone room today, for the marvelous job you're doing, for the people who feed us during the KSFR Fun Drive, to all of those of you who make it possible for this radio station to go on. It's your public radio station. Call to give a contribution. And by the way, if you can't do it by telephone because you're driving or whatever, when you get to your office and maybe you've got a computer, go to ksfr.org if you're too shy to get on the phone. Go to ksfr.org. You can make a pledge from there. And you can get one of the fine KSFR t-shirts or coffee travel mugs or other many fine logo items from KSFR. We are simulcasting at 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. 101.1 FM is our new home. Please give us a call, 428-1393, if you don't mind the telephone, 428-1393, or 1-877-907-KSFR. That's 907-5737. Special call to new listeners today, new contributors, people who have never contributed to public radio before. Do it and do it now. That's what I've got to say. My name is Mary Charlotte, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow, and we'll actually be talking about a tremendous movie about the decline of elephant populations, which is going to be screening this weekend at the Lenzic. We're going to be doing all sorts of other good shows on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day, and call right now, 428-1393. You've got 10 more minutes to get Robert Perry's book, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, 428-1393. Hasta mañana. Ciao.